Okay, we might make a start. So welcome everyone to this morning's session. My name's Josh Corrigan, I'll be your chair for today. Here this morning we've got a presentation by a long-term friend of mine, Adam DeRussy, on using data and analytics to drive strategy. I've known Adam for quite a long time, and he's basically co-founded Quantium, the actuarial consulting firm, in 2002, where he actually now employs over 90 staff across consulting, software development, and media planning. Adam advises clients in industries such as insurance, banking, retail, telecommunications, media, and gaming on using data to help inform pricing, marketing, and customer strategy. So I look forward to a very interesting presentation from Adam today. Just on the housekeeping side, if I can remind everyone to fill out the feedback forms on their way out. Those feedback forms are very important to give feedback to the Institute. And perhaps if you could just leave them on the back table on your way out. There is a microphone, so if you do have questions during question time, please come up to the microphone. The session is being recorded. There'll be a five-minute bell towards the end. And then a full-time bell as well. So I've been told Adam should be speaking for about 30 to 40 minutes, so that should leave about 15 to 20 minutes for discussion. So without further ado, I'll hand it over to Adam.
Okay, thank you, Josh. Now, apologies, my voice is a little bit croaky, so if I cough to the side a few times, I do apologise in advance. Thank you for coming, everyone. I know it's early in the morning, a bit of a graveyard session after the dinner last night, but I do appreciate your attendance. So my presentation today is all around using data and analytics to drive strategy, and what I'm going to focus on doing is just giving a few examples of the sort of work that that I've done over the last 10 years, as well as just some other things we've seen in different industries where data and analytics are really at the core of a lot of the most successful businesses in the world at the moment. And I think where actuaries have huge opportunities to be doing work, and at the moment, as a profession, I really don't think that we're, as a profession, grabbing those opportunities. But I'll challenge that as we go through. So I just thought I'd start. I just put up here. This is not meant to be a promo for my business because there's no potential clients in the room. But I just thought I'd give you a sense of the sort of clients that we work with. We're a firm of actuaries. I've got 60 fellows or associates in our business, basically advising clients in a whole range of industries. So we do work with insurance companies. So that, you know, some of the general insurance clients that we work for is more traditional actuarial work. But I've left those guys off here, and I've really put up here other businesses that we work with in different industries where we're doing non-traditional work. So we work with the banks, but we're not doing work with other actuaries in banks. We're working with product managers and heads of marketing and heads of strategy and that sort of thing. So like Josh mentioned in our intro, we do work for a lot of the telecommunication companies. We're increasingly working with retailers. I'll give you a few examples of how we're working with retailers, gambling companies, all sorts of different things. I think the thing that our clients have got in common is that they collect data. And if you look around the place, the companies are collecting data like never before. You've got all sorts of organisations that in the past have had no data. So for example, Woolworths in the past, no customer data. In the past, Woolworths might have had their scan data that they understand that, you know, how many sales they've made in a day and what the basket composition of those sales were, each sale. But they didn't know anything about their customers. So now you've got things like the Everyday Rewards loyalty program where they're actually capturing the contact details of 5 million, I think there's about 5 million now, Australians. And for each of those customers, they then understand what they actually buy. So they've suddenly got a very powerful database of customer attributes for 5 million people and their purchasing behaviour, which obviously then they can analyse to try and cross-sell different sorts of products to individual customers. So I'll give another example on that one at the moment. But there's lots of examples of this. I mean, pardon me, Woolworths is one example. Maya One's another good example where I was at a presentation that the chief exec of Maya gave last year, actually, and he was saying that of the $100 million a year that Maya spent on advertising, $50 million of that is now on direct one-to-one communications through their Maya One program. So this is now, rather than advertising on TV, they're spending all their money advertising. You get your own email tailored to you, given what you've already purchased, then the next thing they're trying to sell you. So they're not trying to sell someone in Darwin the same sort of thing they'd be trying to sell someone in Sydney. And there's loads of other examples. I'll give a couple more of these as we go through. But you know, presumably on some of these things, you might subscribe to loyalty programs and you might give your contact details. And in other cases, you're probably not even aware of just how much data is being tracked by companies. Say, for example, television. It won't take long until pretty much every click of a button that you make on your television is tracked by, say, Foxtel. Once it moves to internet TV, which is probably a couple of years away, IPTV, there are some providers already, like Fetch, but at that point, companies like Foxtel will know every single button you press and can then link it to you as an individual, and you can start to get into things like tailored advertising for individuals, which is already happening in the US. So basically our business is we try and find these guys and help them make sense of all that data. Because a lot of them know that the data is a core part of the strategy. Like that retail conference I mentioned, I went to pretty much every chief exec that got up there, and it was all the chief execs of all the major retailers. I was amazed. All of them almost got up there and said, data is our number one thing that we need to be working on. And for me, data is the thing that precedes actually analytics and insight from that data. They're all focused at the moment on capturing the data, and most of them don't really know what to do with it yet. So I think if you combine that data capture with changes in the way consumers are behaving, it leads to some pretty fundamental changes in the way that businesses operate. Increasingly, people seem to be putting information about themselves online. I don't know how many Facebook users are in the room. It's probably not a representative demographic of society, but it does seem that the youth of today put a lot of information about themselves and their friends and everything online, and there's lots of examples where companies are now using that information for targeted marketing. I'll give you an example a bit later on. But also just things like iPhones and the phone technology now, it's just incredible how much tailoring that means that companies can do to you as an individual with marketing. And again, I'll give a couple of examples of that. So, like I said, I think all of that combination of the information that companies can now collect about you as an individual and changes in the way that we all behave mean that there's changes in the way that businesses need to operate. And number one thing I think is that marketing has to be targeted. As consumers, we don't really tolerate messages that don't hit the mark. If you get email spam, basically it won't take long for you to think something's spam if you get an email from a company that you may trust, but 3 days in a row it's rubbish and it's not targeted to. You're going to press delete and it won't take long for you to unsubscribe to something. So increasingly companies are needing to make sure that when they do communicate to their customers, it's relevant and it's actually something that customer wants. Also, I think consumers want to be treated as individuals. I don't think we want to be treated as an aggregate, and I'll give you a couple of examples of that later. And also there's a lot of stats around at the moment talking about how as consumers we're much more likely to trust recommendations from other independent people rather than companies themselves. So you think about, say, websites like TripAdvisor and all of these sorts of things, where when you go to research a holiday, you don't necessarily just go and look up a company website. You look up a website where there's thousands of people are giving their own opinions about those hotels they might have stayed in. They give their recommendations. So there's all of this other information that's been collected by people outside of your own brand. So you no longer have control about the message that you're promoting for your business, because other people are also posting what they think about your brand, and if they don't like it, then you can't really stop them from doing that. And so there's lots of information around, I don't know where people get these numbers, but how much more likely people are to trust those sorts of recommendations rather than a brand's own advertising. So I'll just give you a couple of examples of how we see that play out, and some of them are how we've, as a business, helped our clients do things, and others are extensions of that. So this is one example of some work that we did with eBay. We do a lot of work with eBay. Presumably most of you are familiar with eBay. You go on to the website, there's a stack of items you can buy. A lot of those are auction items where you can bid. A lot of them increasingly now are things that you can actually just buy. eBay sees themselves as like a an online marketplace, like a Westfield Online. So eBay track, as you can imagine, very detailed information about everyone. They know your details, and they know what things that you're bidding on, what things that you've bought, and so on. And that can tell you a lot of things about you as a customer. There's something like 50,000 categories of goods that you can buy on eBay, which obviously kind of branch out from the highest level categories to the lowest. And if you're an eBay user, you probably get an email from eBay every few days with different offers and promotions and things that they're trying to get you to bid on and so on. So we did some work, or one of the pieces of work we've done with eBay was helping them get that targeting of those emails to an individual level. So they have the ability in their systems that I think they've got something like 5 million active users in Australia. They've got the ability to actually send out targeted emails to each individual, where I get a different email to Josh and get a different email to everyone else in the room. So what we did is we did the work to say, well, let's look at the things that person A has bought, and what are the 12 items that we'll put in an email to them. So if you look at this, this was just like the email creative that they used. All of this section here was standard. And it's just the bit on the right with the item list. That was every individual of the 5 million people got a different combination of 12 items, which kind of were a factor of things that they've bought before and what might be the next stretch category and so on. To be honest, it's not complicated modelling work from an actuarial perspective. But it was really interesting to see, because you'd see things like if someone's bought size 6 and size 8... It's interesting to see the correlations in the different things that people bought, because often if someone bought a size 6 boys' clothing, often they bought a size 8 girls' or boys' clothing as well. So you see, okay, well, there's obviously a family with two kids. Then they'd be buying toys. And so once you do that work, it's not then hard to find tens of thousands of people who've bought those sorts of things and then gone and bought a kid's DVD or something like that. And so if eBay could get customers to stretch the categories in which they're purchasing, then they'd be just much more likely to keep using eBay in a wide range of ways. It's actually amazing how much people spend on women's fashion on eBay, by the way. It's their number one category by a long way. So this is an example. So this is not work that we've done, but this is another example which kind of takes that to the next level, which is something that Amazon's just launched in the US. I don't know if it's still a beta version, but it's a bit bizarre, where essentially what you can do with Amazon now, most people are probably familiar with Amazon, and their recommendations program on Amazon is very good, I think. You go there, you search for an item, and it'll very quickly say, people who've bought this movie have also bought this movie. And often, obviously, that prompts you to buy things that you might not have thought about. Or you might say, actually, I like this movie. What other movies are similar? So they've taken that to the next level now, where they've now got it so you can actually integrate all of your Facebook details. So effectively, you press a button, and it will import your Facebook details plus all of your friends' details. There's big warning signs there on the top right-hand corner, saying that they'll never share they'll never contact your friends, so they commit to doing that. But what they then do is they pretty quickly create this calendar where instead of only now recommending things for me to buy for myself, now it's saying, well, did you know it's Jason's birthday next Thursday, and based on his likes and dislikes from his information on Facebook, we think that he would be interested in this DVD or this book. Click here to buy it now. And so I think it's really smart. It's a smart way of using this external data and, frankly, making it easy for you as a consumer to buy something that's relevant. Like for me, if there was actually a button that said, buy it, press here to have it wrapped and sent to him without you having to do anything, then I would... that's the point that I'll sign up. But I'll have to jump onto Facebook and set all this stuff up first as well. But... yeah, it's a really interesting example of taking that recommendation stuff to the next level, but it's all using data. Just as a quick show of hands, how many people have heard of Groupon? That's okay, that's remarkably low. So I don't mean that as an insult, by the way. So Groupon's the fastest growing company in the world at the moment. It's the first company, it's the fastest company to ever reach $1 billion in revenue. So it's a pretty remarkable company. I just thought I'd give you a quick 1.5 minute video of what Groupon's doing, and I'll tell you a little bit about it.
What is Groupon? Groupon is an easy way to get huge discounts while discovering fun activities in your city. Each day we feature a cool new experience at an unbeatable price in dozens of cities across the country. From restaurants, theaters, spas, stores, and special events, we work with the best local businesses to offer one deal each day at an incredibly low price. Using Groupon is easy. Check in every day to see the new deal, or subscribe to our daily alerts and the deal will be emailed to you each morning. If you see something you want to do, sign up. If enough people sign up, the deal will activate. By requiring a minimum number of buyers, we can guarantee businesses lots of customers and ensure that our subscribers receive maximum discounts. We call it collective buying power. When you find a deal you love, just enter your name and credit card. You won't be charged unless enough people join for the deal to activate. To make sure the deal reaches its minimum, tell your friends using Facebook, Twitter, email, or carrier pigeon. When enough people join, we'll send you your Groupon, which you can print and use like cash. Simple as that. Of course, you won't want to keep your adventures to yourself. Let's say you find a daily deal that's just perfect for that special someone. Groupons make great gifts, so send one to a friend. Or give a Groupon gift certificate good towards any future Groupon purchase. With dozens of cities and growing, Groupons are a great way to give a gift that goes farther for your friends and family across America. Groupon makes it easier than ever to assemble a huge group of people with the bargaining power to get amazing deals. So what are you waiting for?
Okay. Now, I'm not here as a Groupon salesman, by the way, but I just think it's a really interesting story about using data and building a successful business. So I'll just tell you a little bit more about Groupon. Groupon launched in November 2008 in the States, so not long ago, just a bit over 2 years ago. Like I said, they're the fastest company to ever reach $1 billion in sales. In November last year, they knocked back Google for $6 billion for their business. Now, having built my own business, I have to say, if someone offered me $6 billion after 2 years, it takes something to knock them back and knock Google back. And at the moment, well, there's a lot of information around if you Google it. Basically, they look like they're heading towards a $25 billion IPO later this year, maybe next year. And that valuation is not inconsistent with some of the capital they've raised recently and the equity they've given away to get that capital. So it's an incredible business success so far in 2 years, and probably the most interesting bit to me is that one of their copycat competitors, a company called Living Social, which is owned by Amazon, they're on track to become the second fastest company to ever reach $1 billion in sales. So there's something about this category. So the reason for Groupon's success is they've pretty quickly built up a database of 70 million people in the States. So I don't know what that is in percentage terms. I can't remember the population of the States. But let's say it's 20% of 20% of Americans have now signed up for Groupon, where essentially they get sent this daily offer in the email, and if enough people take up that offer, then the deal is live, like they said. And they're forecasting $3 to $4 billion in revenue this year, or sales this year. And they take a 30 to 50% commission on every sale. So they might be selling you something at a 60% discount. So it might be they say, here's something that's normally $100, today it's $40, and then Groupon keep $20 of that, and the actual company themselves keep $20. And they're doing it because it's a very cheap way for them to get thousands of customers to their brand they otherwise wouldn't get. They're only paying when a customer actually comes, and then they're hoping to obviously keep on going business. It's a genius idea. A lot of the products they sell are obviously women's stuff that you get. You know, no offense to the women, I'm not being sexist here, but I picture these young women just Facebooking the crap out of these deals, and suddenly it just goes berserk. So a lot of the things are around women's health and beauty and all that sort of stuff, but increasingly it's around restaurants and so on. So there's been about 1,000 copycat businesses spring up in the last year and a half, I guess, to copy what they're doing. In Australia, a whole group of them launched last year. If you haven't heard of Groupon, you probably haven't heard of a lot of these brands. Kudo, I know, has been on TV a bit, but I mean, you got one, Scoopon there. I think it's almost a bit embarrassing. Scoopon took Groupon.com.au. They did all this stuff. Like, they don't sound like a credible business when you do that, but I mean, their sales numbers so far are incredibly high. To remind myself. So the sorts of companies that are behind these brands here, which, like I say, you probably don't know a huge amount about the brands yet, but you will. so Spreetz is owned by Yahoo 7. They went and bought that. Scoopon's owned by a company called Catch of the Day. That Catch of the Day are another business that have daily emails where they say, we've got these 10,000 gadgets today only that we can sell for $13. But it doesn't matter. You don't have to have 1,000 people sign up until it sells. They could potentially just sell one of them. So that was kind of like an early version of these group buying. Jump On, it's owned by Living Social, which is Amazon. Qdo's owned by Microsoft and PBL. Our deal's owned by Network 10 and so on. So you've got all of the major media companies, if you like, are all have jumped onto this as a big form of advertising going forward and paid ridiculous amounts of money again for these businesses after 1 or 2 years of kind of setting up. Now, this is why I think you're going to hear about them in Australia. If you look at the revenue numbers, I should have built this slide, but I didn't have the technical capability. But the black line here is a forecast that a company called Telsyte, they're just like a research company, they put out this forecast of what they think the group buying industry in Australia is going to do. And if you look at that, it's a pretty healthy forecast that you go from mid last year that there's none of these companies sold anything in June last year, saying that it would be a $500 million business within 3 years. The blue line is from some data that we've got, which I'll talk about in a moment, which is looking at actual sales of these companies. And we're saying that in January this year, it's already hit a $300 million per annum category. So, I mean, I think any actuary can have a go at trying to project what that blue line's going to look like, but I think we can all pretty confidently say it's going to get beyond $500 million within 3 years and most likely by the middle of this year. And it's interesting, since I put this presentation together last week, this Telsyte have come out, I think, this week with revised numbers, and it's very consistent with the numbers we've got there in the blue. The way they do their numbers, by the way, is they just... Because you can go on the website, so you can see, say Scoopon, they'll only have 4 items up for sale today, and it actually tracks how many have sold, because the whole idea is you're trying to get people to all buy so that enough of you have bought. So they track what the amount is, and they track the number of people that bought it, and they just track that every day and add it up to get the revenue. So it's an interesting category. And I guess why it's relevant, apart from an interesting story, why I've put up there is being such a copycat type of business, I mean, it's very easy for competitors to come in and do exactly what Groupon does, and they could say, well, rather than take a 30 to 50% commission, we'll take a 1% commission. So what Groupon are saying, they claim that their big first mover advantage is that they'll be able to get targeted to individuals. So rather than offer everyone in Sydney the one deal today, which is the way these companies work at the moment, they're saying that they'll be able to have algorithms in the background that look at the demographics of the person buying, what they've bought before, where they live and all that sort of stuff to serve up relevant ads. This is an example. Again, I'm just taking a male perspective, but there's only so many days in a row that I could get ads like this until I would... and it's an attractive woman, don't get me wrong. But, I'm not going to buy a Brazilian wax. And a lot of these ads are things like that. There are a lot of female health and beauty stuff, and so you can see that actually you need these ads to be relevant for me to be buying, for you to be buying, and so on. And that means everyone needs to be getting their own offers. And so Groupon are saying that they'll have the data to be able to do that, and they've probably already got that. And they reckon that at the moment they've got 50,000 businesses in the US that are on the queue that want to get their items promoted in different cities. So they've got, again, they've got the inventory, they've got enough different things they could be promoting to 70 million different people. You can start to see that actually everyone will be getting different offers. They still need enough out there to kind of go and get the group to buy. But so they reckon the whole success is going to come down to data and analytics. And again, this is the theme of my talk is this is the way that successful businesses are going to be running now. Everything's about targeting. another example is just with augmented reality apps on your iPhone. Again, some of you are probably very familiar with this stuff. Some of you probably don't have an iPhone or have never seen one of these apps. But basically here we're talking about apps where you can point your phone at something and it'll bring up information. I remember seeing that movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise years ago, and I thought it was complete rubbish. And I remember there was Tom Cruise was walking through a shopping centre, and as he walked through the stores, as he was walked past, were giving him like were saying hi, so and so, welcome back. We got this on offer today. I remember thinking it was just so fanciful as a concept. And it's basically here already now with your phone. If you, it's not going to take long for your phone to be doing that sort of thing at the moment. I'll give you a couple of examples where it already does. But these augmented reality apps are basically like you point your phone at something and it brings up information. So it might be something as simple as you're doing a tour of a historic building, and rather than have a tour guide tell you about it, you can point your phone at it and it will actually recognise where you are and tell you all about what you're looking at. I think the first example in the App Store was the Paris subways and London buses, where you could just pull out your phone, press a button, and it would tell you in what directions the closest subway stations and bus stations are. As you point it down the street, it can tell you where different stores are. It'll say there's a McDonald's 500 metres down to your left and all this sort of stuff. So you can see that, again, a lot of companies are going to want to use that targeting for advertising. CBA have an example you might have seen, that where you can point it at a property and it'll bring up the last time that property was sold and how much it was sold for and all sorts of stuff like that. So there's some really cool stuff around this. So I mentioned before about consumers being more likely to trust things that other people say about a brand rather than themselves. So this is another business, Urban Spoon, you might have heard of, you might not have, where, again, you can say, well, here I am on my phone. It will bring up what are the restaurants in the area, what are the reviews that different consumers have given it. So 86% like this Asian restaurant down the street, and it's this sort of price category. So it's, again, it's like your TripAdvisor and that sort of stuff. You just pull out your phone and it will just tell you anything that's nearby and what other people thought of it. So you can start to see that this is now apps being created by third parties, that these restaurants have got no control over their own advertising. It's other people using data to do that. So we're talking to lots of businesses around doing this sort of stuff for them, around them creating apps using their data to be more targeted. And then Facebook, of course, they're going to be a behemoth in all of this sort of stuff. So they've come out with this their own version of like these deals type of thing, which is all about the location that you're in. So again, I mean, there's just incredible statistics around the number of people using Facebook. It just blows me away. If you've ever got time, just go onto YouTube or something and search for a couple of videos that talk about social media revolutions and Facebook, and the numbers blow you away. Essentially here, this is now Facebook have got all sorts of companies wanting to promote their items through Facebook on the phone, so through this Facebook Deals, which has only just launched in the US, where it would recognise again where you are on your phone, just sort of through the GPS, and it will say, oh, Sharp's Coffee just around the corner has got an offer. If you go in there and press this button on your phone, so let's see this check-in thing there, you can check in and you can get a dollar off your coffee or whatever it might be, 50% off a cup of coffee in this case. And sometimes there'll be group things where it needs to have a certain number of people check in, or it might be things like go to the store 5 times and on the 5th time you get it free and stuff like that. So rather than carry around like one of those things at your chicken shop where they stamp it or something like that, you'd just be signing in on Facebook and pressing a button, which, again, for the demographic in this room is probably not so exciting, but for a generation that's coming through addicted to Facebook and basically walks around all day on their phone on Facebook anyway, it's just it's going to be huge. So the other thing that Facebook are doing, which is a bit scary for the banks, is they're getting into the whole payment space. So they're trying to get it. So not only would you do that, but you then actually pay the coffee shop through Facebook credits. So you start to use Facebook as a clearing system, a bit like PayPal at the moment. So that's a scary thought for the banks. A scary thought for me, actually. I wouldn't want to be having Facebook as my bank yet, but it just feels inevitable. If they want to do it, they'll probably do it. So just, I guess, a bit of a change in the presentation. I'll just give you some other examples now of some work that we've done using data for different businesses. Some of you may have seen this from a presentation I gave at the General Insurance Seminar. But we're fortunate enough, we've got access to the transaction data of one of the major banks. So it's a product that we've built called Market Blueprint. What we've got, it's an agreement with one of the big four banks where we get from them all of their transaction data for their entire customer base. So they've got over 2 million consumers. It's an Australian bank. We never get the name and address or credit card number or anything like that might scare you. if this already doesn't. We don't get anything that's personal information, basically, but we do get things like it's a male, age 33, living in this postcode with an estimated income of X and so on. We just don't get anything that could identify people as an individual. So once we've got that, we've then got every credit card, FPOS, BPAY or direct debit transaction that that customer's made in the last couple of years. And essentially we can then use that database to come up with insights and aggregate them and sell them to other companies. So I'll just give you a few examples of how we're doing that. Here's the first one, which is around if someone wanted to launch travel insurance as an example. Come to this example because one of our clients, I'll dub them in, Amy, they did launch a travel insurance product. At the time when they launched a travel insurance product, they promoted it very heavily on Getaway, the TV show. And I always thought it was a bit of a strange thing to do, to advertise it on Getaway, mainly because maybe I travel a lot overseas but I don't watch Getaway a lot. So just my sample of one, I thought, well, that's not a show I watch, it's interesting. But it was a big departure of the way that Amy typically advertised. They actually got the guy from Getaway on the ad, the whole thing. They went to town on this Getaway theme. That's a funny story in itself. The guy rewrote their whole ad because it wasn't funny enough for him to say and all this stuff, but it's an aside. So I thought we'll do some work with them to actually see whether they targeted that correctly. So first thing we did was we used this bank data to actually understand, well, people who actually travel overseas, what do they look like? So if you think about it from the bank data, we know where people live and we know what ages they are and that sort of stuff, but we also can see if they're transacting overseas, and by that I mean they physically swipe their card or use their card overseas somewhere. So we've now got an indicator of someone's travel overseas, and in this case we're just plotting on a map in Sydney, and it looks very much like an income plot in Sydney, that the higher income postcodes are much more likely to travel overseas in the next 12 months than the lower income areas. So kind of not a huge surprise, you wouldn't think, in that chart. We then compared that to the viewing footprints of different TV shows. So this is now a completely different set of data that we've created, where we've gone and footprinted hundreds of TV shows and newspapers and so on to work out who's actually watching what show. And if you look at... So the way you buy media, by the way, is you typically buy media in a metro market. So you buy 100 tarps, it's called, in Sydney, and that means you're expecting, on average, every person to see an ad once. It might be every second person to see an ad twice and so on. But you buy 100 tarps for Sydney Metropolitan, that means across all of Sydney you'll get however many million people see your ad that live in Sydney. But the reality is that different TV shows are not watched evenly over in different areas within Sydney. So Getaway, if you look at the people that are watching Getaway, they're much more skewed towards western and northwestern Sydney and skewed away from the high-income areas. So if you're buying 100 tarps of TV exposure in Sydney on Getaway, you're probably more like buying 150 tarps in western Sydney and 50 tarps in the North Shore. So in the exact area where you want people to be seeing your ad, they're much less likely to see your ad, and all the people that don't travel overseas are actually the ones watching Getaway, which is what I, in my sample of one, I don't want to sound like I'm being smart-ass here, but that was my take of it. I travel overseas, so I don't need to watch a show about London because I've already been there enough. But I think a lot of the people who watch Getaway are aspiring travellers. And obviously there's a mixture, but I'm sure some people in the room watch Getaway all the time. But different TV shows have different viewing footprints, and it's again another example of how you can use data to say, well, if this is your target market, how can you find the TV shows or websites or whatever it might be that are most correlated with who you're trying to get your message across to? Just another quick example. So this is now looking at, again, using this banking data to try and understand the broader shopping behaviour of customers of a certain brand. So in this particular picture here, we've got RACV in Victoria. So for those not familiar, it's basically similar to NRMA in New South Wales. And we're looking at their customers over 50. What other brands are they most likely to transact with because they're an RACV customer? So we don't have Coles and Woolworths on the chart because pretty much everyone will shop with Coles and Woolworths at some point during the year. So this doesn't say... it's more like because you've shopped at RACV, you are more likely to shop with these brands. And if you look at the sorts of brands on there, you're looking at kind of high-end brands, I would say, things like BMW... a lot of charities, a lot of decent hotels and so on. They look like fine citizens, but maybe a touch, touch boring compared to the AAMI customers. The AAMI customers, again, over 50, people who transact with AAMI are much more likely, as an example, to be into gambling rather than charity. So I'm the under-50s version of... Well, actually, I'd give money to charity. I shouldn't be hard on myself. But AAMI obviously sponsor a lot of horse racing stuff, and that comes through at the bottom there. You might not know the logos, but they're... a lot of the jockey clubs and casinos and stuff are coming through that AAMI customers are more likely to be spending money, those sorts of things, more likely to be doing things like skiing and stuff than an RACV customer. Now, I'm sure if we actually got it tighter and said, well, let's just make sure it's only 50 to 60, because maybe the average RACV customer is slightly older, but you get the picture. And if you then compare that to a budget direct customer over 50... Yeah, budget direct, obviously they've got the word budget in their brand name, so they appeal to a different sort of base again. And you look at the other brands that their customers are transacting with, you can see a completely different type of consumer again, much more skewed towards bargain type brands. So you don't have a BMW or a Qantas or anything like that there. But you've got a lot of, you know, deals brands. So... how you'd be using this, I guess, is in terms of understanding, first of all, are there different groups of customers that actually transact with your brand? So the way we put it up here is as though there's one type of customer. The reality is there's not. As an example, if I put up Shannon's, the insurance company, on one of these charts, we see that within Shannon's you'll get some customers that are look like they're very high net worth individuals with very expensive cars that they want to insure, and then you'll have another segment which just look like rev heads that... ride into their cars, you know, like just really not necessarily high net worth, but serious car hoons. So you get different segments of customers for different brands, and it's all about those brands then targeting their segments. There's another different example, again, using the same data. So this is now for a company that spends a lot of money on dropping catalogues. I mean, now this is a whole industry, I have to tell you, that's just outrageously... untargeted in some occasions. So what you'll have here is this is a company that spent basically most of their marketing budget is in catalogs. So I think someone like Target, to give you an idea, I think organisations like that might spend $100 million a year on catalog drops. So it's a lot of money for some companies. This isn't Target that we're talking about here, but you get some businesses that spend a lot of money on catalogs. So this particular company, what they did was they would just drop catalogues in a 5-kilometre radius of their store. So they said, we've got one store in Sydney, we just drop within 5 kilometres of that store. Is that the right strategy? And then they had once a year, they would actually ask people, like, when they went into the store, what postcode are you from? So you might have got those sorts of questions from Rebel and places like that, Harvey Norman sometimes. It tends to be rubbish that you get out of the back of it a lot of the time, because a lot of the time the operators themselves don't want to ask the question, so they just type in the same postcode all the time. So it's a very biased way of getting that information. But what we did here is we said, okay, well, we'll help this company with their catalogue targeting. So the first thing we did was looked at, well, where are the people who are actually transacting in the store? Where do they come from? And it is kind of like a 5K radius. It's maybe a little bit more of a skew there north, but roughly around that black market there in terms of where the actual numbers of transactions are coming from. If you look at the amount that people are spending when they come into the store, that's heavily skewed towards higher income areas. So now that definitely doesn't look like a 5-kilometre radius anymore. And then when you combine the two, again, it doesn't look anything like a 5-kilometre radius anymore of where this business is high value, or basically where their revenue is coming from, if you like. You've got things like Palm Beach, which are way outside that radius, but represent a decent chunk of their revenue. And their previous catalogue drop wasn't reaching that. Now, the hard bit of doing this work is to be honest, when I presented this, the marketing manager I presented it to said, well, what do we do with this? And I said, well, don't you drop your catalogues in the red areas and not the blue areas? She said, oh, right. I'm dead serious. And she said, and she nodded, and I thought, she still doesn't get the concept. And I said... I said, is that a controversial idea? She said, yeah, that would be controversial. And I said, why? She said, because we drop within 5 kilometres of the store. And so it took a long time, actually, for them to actually change to do that. But So, yeah, so even though you've got a lot of businesses that are very data savvy, you've also got a lot of traditional businesses that, when they're not used to data, this is very, very simple stuff that is not necessarily easily interpreted by some people. Another, I've only got a couple more examples, but again, using the same sort of data, this is now around store placement and store refurbishments. So you've got a remarkable number of businesses that when they're trying to work out where to put a new store or which stores to refurbish, because often that's just as big of an investment cost for these companies as where to put a new store, they really guess where to put a new store. It might sound insulting the way I say that, but I've met with a lot of big organisations where they say, look, we just make it up. We've got no idea. We think this is a sensible area because of X, Y, and Z, but we've got no data to support it whatsoever. So we can use information, external information like this, pardon me, to try and understand, well, what's the size of a market in the area? So it might be that you don't have a store in Sydney at all. Well, what's the size of the market for what you're trying to sell in different areas? Again, that might be something that businesses have a pretty good feel of, or maybe they don't. But also, if you do have stores in a variety of different areas within Sydney, say, for example, well, where are there gaps in where the customers are spending money but they're not spending it with you? So if this was a retailer that had stores in lots of different locations, you'd say, right, well, in the blue areas, they're not capturing as much of those customer spend versus the red areas where they're capturing a lot of it. And, I mean, this particular example, we were able to look at points in time and say, well, here's what it was before you refurbish your stores, and after you refurbish your stores, this is what happened. Or after your competitor refurbished their stores, this is what happened, and so on. And it doesn't have to be banking data you can be doing that with, but there's it's just an example. And then the last example, this is something that we're putting a lot of time in for our business at the moment to try and get to the bottom of, is around trends in online sales. There's very weak information out there at the moment around what's happening online in terms of volumes of sales. I'm kind of getting sick of these reports from Forrester Research, who are a credible company, don't get me wrong, where they estimate the size of the online market is $32 billion or whatever they estimate. And it really is based on research. And you get front page stories in the paper based on 1,000 people have been surveyed around what they spend online, and then that gets extrapolated to 20 million people. I mean, we laugh, but it's true. That's the way these numbers are come up with, because there's no other way of doing it. So what we're trying to do at the moment is use this sample of 2 million people that we've got to try and work out which of those transactions are online transactions. And in some cases, that's really easy because it's an online-only business. And in some cases, it's tougher where you've got businesses that have got bricks-and-mortar stores and online. And the credit card description doesn't always say, JB Hi-Fi online as an example. It might say something different. But we're doing a lot of work around that to then try and understand, well, what are the trends in different categories? So what categories actually are we seeing the online sales go up, and how much, and how much of a threat is it, and what types of customers are actually starting to spend more money online and so on, and to what extent are people splitting their purchasing behaviour between online and bricks and mortar and so on. So as you can imagine, the numbers are, I mean, this is an example here just for toy retailing, showing that the proportion of toys that were purchased went from 5.5% or something to 8% in the year. So, I mean, don't quote me on the numbers, but it's roughly something like that. And when you look at it by category, you're obviously getting a pretty big increase in lots of categories. So online is an increasing threat to retailers. Whether it's the reason why Borders and Angus and Robertson and so on went down is a completely different question, but it certainly is a threat. And then we can do things, like I said, about profiling what types of people are buying online versus bricks and mortar, and you can start thinking about, well, what's it going to look like in 5 years' time? So I'll just leave you with one last insult, if you like, in that I think we've got a problem when a guy that looks like this is saying that the challenges for us, well, I'm saying that the challenges for us to be as sexy as this guy's saying we can be. But you've got, I mean, I honestly believe that this is a huge area in which people like actuaries can be doing work. I don't know why there's not more actuaries working outside of traditional areas. I think that there's lots of companies that have got lots of data, and they've got lots of challenges with that data, and they just need people to help them with it. And we're doing it. I know there's some other actuaries doing it, but otherwise you've just got statisticians and lots of people that just know how to use Excel that are helping companies do this stuff. And I believe the same as what this guy believes, in that I think going forward, it's not going to reduce. You're going to have more and more companies wanting to get more and more out of their customer data to get more and more target. And I think the opportunities for Actuaries are huge. And I think it's an exciting type of work for Actuaries to get involved in. But obviously I've got a huge bias because it's what I do. But, I think the ability to take data and make sense of it for companies is something that we all have traditionally done for insurance companies, and I don't know why, as a profession, we tend to be fairly limited to continuing to do it for traditional types of clients. But that's my end of my presentation. I'm certainly very happy to take any comments or more questions.
Thanks very much, Adam. So I'll open up for a discussion now. So if anyone has a question, please use the microphone stand. Is anyone going to kick us off, or any burning questions out there?
Hi, Darren Stevens from Bravura Solutions. Adam, thanks very much. Great presentation, very thought-provoking. I've got two areas that aren't really outside of our field that I'd like some perspective, your perspective on. The first is around underinsurance and the fact that a lot of life insurance companies are trying to encourage more people to take up increased insurance, life insurance. And Mia Friedman did a session at the FSC Life conference where she was talking about 80% of the purchasing decisions online are made by women, and that by hitting women with a shock up front about, you know, what your life's going to be like without your partner, etc., doesn't actually resonate. It scares them off. So whether you had any perspectives around using data to encourage that or different ways of channeling into the insurance industry. And then a second one is around superannuation and engaging members. And I deal with a lot of super funds who are looking at doing a lot of data mining to try and re-engage their members. So I don't know whether you've come across anything like that or have any outside of the box type of thoughts around how we can do increase insurance and engage members.
Thanks, Darren. Short answer is no. We haven't done. We haven't tended to work with life insurers or super funds and this sort of stuff. I think, to be perfectly honest, one of the reasons is it's a lot easier for me to go to eBay and pitch this idea because their customers actually are interested in hearing from them every 3 days with targeted messages. And I think if I took that to a super fund, they're going to have the same challenge and say, "Well, we don't think our members want to hear from us with an email." So for the sort of stuff that we do, it would be much more challenging because I think the members are going to be much less engaged with their super fund on a daily basis compared with a lot of these other sorts of brands. In terms of the underinsurance and whether there's anything out of the box, I don't know. I don't know that... as it turns out, because it's with a bank and they have a life insurance product, we're not actually allowed to use the data to do anything on life insurance. I've never even tried to think about it, to be honest, apart from with the bank's life insurance arm. So I haven't, because of that, I haven't even tried to think, is there something that we take to a life insurer? I'll give it some more thought and I'll talk to you later maybe. But no, nothing springs immediately to mind. Sorry, the category's just too unsexy for me at the moment.
Hi, Jonathan Cohen, Taylor Fry. What's your impression of sort of the Actuary brand in non-traditional areas? So when you go out to a retail conference, do you say, "Hi, I'm Adam, I'm an Actuary," or do you say, "Hi, I'm Adam, I can help with your data," and maybe try to hide the fact that you're an Actuary because no one really knows what that is?
Yep, okay. I'm always upfront that I'm an Actuary. I don't hide it. I actually think it's a really good point of differentiation. I think people often are interested. They think, "Oh, it's an Actuary." Probably think, "Oh, this would be boring." But I think they pretty quickly get interested in what we can do with that. I mean, I think it's interesting. At least I think, obviously, again, I'm biased. But I think if you're talking to a retail conference and showing them stuff about their own business or their own industry and they've never seen it before, they tend to get interested. So I think I have no reason to hide by an Actuary. I think it's a point of differentiation versus a lot of other people out there that do this sort of work. I think the first response, to be honest, probably is if they know an Actuary that it's they got a view of what you're going to be like, and that's often, you know, the typical stereotype that they think you you're going to be very conservative and not very innovative in what you're doing for them, I guess, but But equally, there's lots of people, when you say, and actually they say, oh, actually, I've got some good friends that are actuaries, and that's always surprised by how many people have got friends that are actuaries, actually. Obviously a friendly bunch, but, I certainly don't hide it at all. In fact, we promote it to say we're an actuarial firm, and that's what we do, that's what we're different, and we try and say, and that's why the other guys over there that just know how to use Excel, aren't as good. And one of the things we say about what actuaries do better, because no one wants to hear that we say, oh, we can analyse the data better than the guy next door, because people don't care about that. They don't really. It just sounds like an academic comment. I think what we say is the difference for us as actuaries is, yes, we can analyse the data, but we can also understand the financial elements to do with that. So not just contacting a customer for the sake of it, but then understanding, well, which customer is actually worth the most to attract. So we bring both the analytics, but also the financial dimensions, and then innovation, and that's what we talk about, that what actuaries can do.
Rob Payton, in the education of actuaries, do you feel there are areas where we could improve our education so we would be more useful in this sort of work? And a second question, if you can handle too, the same question as before on super and life insurance, but in relation to healthcare, there is an immense amount of healthcare data out there about, transactional data, because people, just look at Medicare and PBS and what have you, and much of this data is made available publicly. Have you done any work on that?
Okay. Healthcare, not a lot. We're having some discussions with some people. I mean, our vision on that sort of stuff, to be honest, is to take this data that we've got at the moment as a core set of data and then expand it to actually bring in lots of other sources of data. So, as an example, within retail, if we see a Coles transaction for $158.40 in a certain postcode on a certain day, a certain time of day, I then want to get other data to tell me what did they actually buy when they went to Coles. So we want to do the same thing within healthcare, except I know there's some... in terms of what we're looking at, it's more around what are people buying in pharmacies and stuff like that. But we know we haven't done a lot in healthcare in that area. On the education, I've got strong views, but I don't want to... I'm sure it's a very difficult process to educate people, and you need the volunteers and all that sort of stuff. But it's very tough for me to, with our staff that come through, and when you get guys from university come in and they start working on this sort of work, to tell them that it's worth them studying the exams. Now, I do, because I think having a fellowship and being an actuary is a point of differentiation. Like I said, I always tell people I'm an actuary. I'm very proud to be an actuary. I think it's a very useful credentials to have, but it's very hard to tell that to a 21-year-old guy that's doing this work, and you've got to tell him to go sit the life insurance exam. And frankly, it's completely irrelevant to what he's doing or she's doing. And we've got a lot of people in that category. And to be honest, it's a little bit like that for the Institute in general. I've had this conversation with Melinda. I'm not trying to criticise the Institute here, but it's when you work outside of the traditional fields, it's very hard to say to these 21, 22, 23-year-olds that you should get involved in the Institute, because all they see in the Institute is they get a monthly magazine and they don't know anyone in the magazine and don't really care about many of the articles. So it's very difficult to get these guys engaged. And I don't know what the solution is. I'm not proposing that we have a marketing analytics subject. But it is difficult. Obviously, things like the control cycle help people think differently. I was in the first year that did the control cycle, so I think that's a good departure from just having to study superannuation for me at the time anyway. But
it's not so much about the Institute, more about the content. Are there obvious content things that should be included in the Institute's syllabus?
Well, but my thing's about the content as well. Sorry, if I'm saying the Institute, I'm meaning content. I mean, the content at the moment is, to qualify, you need to do an investment subject and you need to do a specialism in general insurance or health insurance or whatever. Like, how does that help you if you're doing this sort of stuff? It's very hard to convince someone to dedicate 2 years of their life to do it when it's not relevant to them. I think the biggest gap, personally, I think the biggest gap for most actuaries is communication. And we don't have a communication aspect of qualification. And I go out to talk to the universities a lot, and I don't see it improving in the next 10 years from what I see at the universities. In fact, I see it getting a hell of a lot worse. I think if you've ever been out at the universities, you'd know what I'm talking about. But, you've got a hell of a lot of people that don't speak English at the universities, and that's going to be a real challenge for the profession. I think you're going to end up with a lot of actuaries that are very, very technically focused and can't communicate what they're doing terribly well to business.
I think we've got time for maybe one, maybe two questions more.
So just one thing I can add to that. So I think when you're working outside of a traditional area, I think that communication is just so much more important. Because if we go to clients and we try and tell them how we did something, you see them going to sleep in front of your eyes. They don't really care less how we did it. In fact, I learned that very often. We went to a client, we pitched all this stuff, we had all this great content, and they really didn't care. And then I put up a map of like average spend by postcode, and then all these people come alive and say, oh, look, my postcode's worth more than yours. And it was so trivial. And suddenly realised, okay, people like maps, or people like stuff that is super easy to understand, and they don't really give a hoot about how you did it. They say, look, we trust you know how to do it. Like, that's why you're here, but we just want to know interesting stuff. So I think it's just all of those different things about communication, just the difference between people getting what you do and not. Sorry.
Glad to hear you talk. Thanks very much for a good presentation. Kathy Lynn, have any large employers or large businesses shown interest in your work in the sense that you could analyse their workforce and turnover and, you know, concentration of vacation time, you know, to help them with staffing or the use of benefits within the organisation or, you know, opening up new branches?
Okay, there's a few different applications there. Some of those, yes, some no. So we have done some work around things like, not sure about staffing, but things like branch locations and where to put advisors and stuff like that. So if you've got hundreds of branches, I'll make a quick demo. If you've got hundreds of branches and you want to have put another 25 business advisors in your bank branches, which branches should you put them in? So we'll help them with that sort of stuff rather than just say, well, let's spread them equally around the city. We'd do that sort of work around Salesforce planning and stuff like that. We haven't really done stuff around workforce, kind of as a total business, but more allocation of staff. There's one of the other ones you said, I can't remember now which one it was, but we had done some work in one of those as well. Things like call centre staffing capacity. So if you can start predicting better how many sales you're going to get from activities you've got, you can then better staff your call centre. So we've done little bits of work around that, but it's not a core part of what we do, but we've done kind of odd projects around that sort of stuff.
Well, I think we'll call time there. Can you all put your hands together and thank Adam for an engaging, fascinating, scary presentation? Thanks.